The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
While the United States waits for the FDA's decision to give Pfizer COVID vaccine emergency use authorization, the wheels are already turning to roll out the vaccine almost immediately. The Pfizer plant in Western Michigan says it is ready to ship 6.4 million doses within 24 hours of approval.
As COVID-19 cases rise and stimulus negotiations stall on Capitol Hill, unemployment claims are up across the country. According to the Department of Labor, about 853,000 people filed new jobless claims last week. That is up about 137,000 from the previous week.
Big news here coming out of Oracle this hour. The company just announcing it is moving its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Austin, Texas. So now it's Oracle. Before it was Tesla's Cybertruck factory, and Elon Musk himself personally is moving to Texas.
Remember, we just had the announcement about Hewlett Packard Enterprise. We also just had the announcement last month about the Fortune 500 company CBRE moving its headquarters to Texas. Next month, we have the formal opening of the Charles Schwab headquarters moved to the Dallas area. And so this has turned into an absolute tidal wave.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
First off, let's talk about the vaccine news. Well, not as big of a catalyst in early November at moving the stock market here by a very wide amount, but it's still a small influence on the direction of trading. And case in point, we can talk about that on how things played out on Tuesday. On Tuesday, Pfizer and BioNTech's vaccine was put to use in the UK, and the FDA said it didn't see anything that could prevent emergency use authorization here in the States. But the move that flipped some profit-taking in the S&P 500 to turn the market positive on the day was the second vaccine headline from Lancet Journal that indicated the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine is safe and effective in preventing symptomatic COVID-19 and protects against severe cases that lead to hospitalization. Finally, on Friday, the FDA advisory panel recommended in a 17-4 vote approval for emergency use on Pfizer and BioNTech's vaccine. But the news had no positive reaction on stocks. Rather, we saw a sell the news reaction as much of the anticipation for that approval was sort of baked in. So most vaccine news, as you may have heard me talk about it last week, has had some diminishing effect on stocks since early November. But like I said on Tuesday, was seen as a positive in turning the market around on an otherwise negative day. A couple of well-known initial public offerings, or IPOs for short, hit the market this week. Some very well-known, very popular household names to some. The first was DoorDash on Wednesday, the American food delivery service. The stock rose 85.8% from its offering price, which seems similar to Snowflake's successful IPO back in September. The IPO price was raised last week to 90 to 95 range from 75 to the $85 range due to demand. But on Wednesday, showing what seemed to be even more demand, where it IPO'd at 102 and closed on the day at 189.51. Closing price values the company north of $60 billion. That compares to Grubhub, similar company valued at $7.2 billion when it was acquired by Just Eat Takeaway, about four times forward sales. This valuation for DoorDash prices it in the high teens times forward sales. And that said, DoorDash does have the largest market share in the U.S. at around 50%, when Grubhub really only has around 20%. The company had an operating loss of about $131 million for the 9 months ending September 30th and is a rather low-margin business. This has brought some concerns over a bit of frothiness in the market. The IPO was flagged by investors in other growth areas where profit-taking caused a decline of 1.9% in the NASDAQ composite for the day. There were two other items that day that also influenced some selling pressure, so it wasn't all just concerns over speculation and overstretched market that hit new records the day before. So let's look at those. The FTC and the U.S. states officially filed separate lawsuits against Facebook for its business practices. Now, Facebook's response Thursday, Facebook's response was that their acquisition of Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp in 2014 were intended to provide better products for its users, and that the acquisitions were already reviewed by antitrust regulators at the time, with the second review by the FTC before clearing it. So going back and wanting to do over after significant investment on the company's part, they said, is just not how antitrust laws are supposed to work. The last item Wednesday that turned investors sour was the proposal of another stimulus package that didn't see any support. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin offered $916 billion, but the Democrats didn't like it because it excluded unemployment benefits and preferred they continue to work with the Republicans on the bipartisan proposal currently in the works. The other successful IPO this week was Airbnb. The following day, I think that was on Thursday, it was known to be successful, but would it do better than DoorDash? That was the question. Yes, it did. Investment bankers raised the price of the IPO from the original $44 to $50 range to $68, but the stock still finished up at $144.71, up 112%, almost 113 from the IPO. One has to wonder why the bankers are really mispricing these IPOs. There's a lot they're leaving out on the table. The stock opened at $146, so nowhere near the IPO. COVID has obviously taken a toll on the company. Revenues were down 30% for the 9 months ending September 30th. But it seems that investors are looking towards future potential here at a valuation near $100 billion. Its forward price to sales figure is at 20 times, with a competitor booking holdings at a price to sales of 9. So a big stretch there. Investors clearly like the Airbnb more. These two high-flying IPOs, so DoorDash and Airbnb, are definitely showing that the IPO market is hot. And it definitely begins to, you know, ask the question, when will growth cost too much? One last item to review this week is the drop in the 10-year yield. We talked about it last week with the spread that continues to widen. It narrowed this week after it was flirting with 1%. So the 10-year treasury rallied and the yield dropped this week to 0.89% finishing on Friday, as investors may be shifting into a little bit more defensive allocation after such a stellar performance in stocks for November. That's it for the major news this week that moved the market.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Investors have bought more than twice as much physical gold this year than they did in 2019. 2017, 18, 19 saw relatively low investment demand for gold, but in 2020, investors bought twice as much physical gold as they bought in the previous year. So we've seen a lot of investment demand moving into gold, and that's why the price is higher. Going forward, we expect that level of investment demand to continue, because we think that investors have looked at the world around them and they say, yeah, I want more gold. And we think that 2021 is going to give them ample reasons to continue to say, I want to own more gold.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you would have thought we'd be hitting new records given all the events for this year, you'd probably be surprised. The market is at all-time highs. Does this continue? Joining us on the program is Jonathan Lin from Technical Focus. Jonathan, let's talk about some of the major averages, whether you're looking at the Dow, or even some of the other indices like small cap stocks. Things seem like they're breaking out now. Is this rally broadening versus, let's say, earlier in the year, which was driven by mainly the FANG stocks?
Well, hi, Jim. First of all, thank you for having me on. And when it comes to indices, definitely we see broadening. There are several indicators to show us that. The advanced decline statistic, for one. The new high versus new low also improved. And in some area, the improvement are actually quite dramatic. When you look at percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average and above their 200-day moving average, they are all showing either record highs or quite historical highs. Like the 200-day moving average stat is at its highest level since April 2010. So that means behind the scene, there are a lot of more participants across different stocks. Now, versus there were a lot of concentration on the high flyers. And that's actually a double-edged sword.
I want to talk about one sector in particular. Actually two. One of the big lagging sectors probably over the last couple of years has been energy. Financials haven't done as well. If you take a look at the charts of, let's say, XLE, the ETF for energy, it looks like a space launch since November. What's going on here?
Well, I think there's a lot of bottom fishing here, not only within the energy sector, but across the market. If you look at stats that are share-based, that is volume statistics, advancing volume versus declining volume, in pure share numbers, those numbers improve quite a bit. However, if you look at the dollar volume, that is the actual amount of money that went into the advancing share versus declining share, that has been going down over the past month or so. So that tells me people are buying actually the cheaper stocks. The average stocks bought are of lower price versus before. So that tells me people are actually buying up cheaper prices. And we can see that within the IT sector, consumer discretionary. So overall, people are scaling back or even selling some of the high price ones and going into the lower ones. And that spills over into several other sectors as well. So you can see energy picked up, some of the industrials that were lagging now are picking up as well. So energy haven't been basically getting the money flowing in are now picking up a lot because the shares are so depressed that the bargain hunters are now boosting the sector quite a lot. And when you think about the fact that if a stock goes down 50%, it needs to move up 100% just to get back to the original level, then you can see that these dramatic moves may seem very impressive over the short term. But in the long run, they haven't improved the structural picture enough. So overall, we still think energy is going to be a problem area for a while. But then these may be early signs of stabilization. Usually the first sign of recovery will be a very sharp V move. If you look at some of these dramatic bear markets, even for the overall market, the first bottom tends to be very sharp. And then it goes into a very elongated period of consolidation, a basing pattern. Energy may be trying to do that. So this is the first time in quite a while we are seeing energy having the improvement. However, that said, it will take quite some time. As Luis Ofen would like to say, Luis Yamada, my mentor, that is, and she said, the bigger the drop, the longer the need for repair. And that is going to be quite true for energy. So yes, we are getting more encouraged by the movement, especially the dramatic movement, but we believe this is just the early stage of it. There'll be a long period of time that it needs to rebuild and the whole sector needs to prove itself worthy again. And so this early part is just bottom fishing, mostly.
Yeah, because when you take a look at the price of oil, it's been in a narrow trading range, $40-$43. It's been that way almost since mid-May. So it's not like the price of energy. It seems like, as you were mentioning, Jonathan, it's a rotation, maybe out of the stuff that's been high priced, like a lot of the technology stocks, and it's moving into value. You're seeing some of the staple companies, your Coca-Colas, your Procter & Gamble's, Johnson & Johnson type stocks starting to move. As you look at this, And you see this broadening. Now we're starting to see, like, for example, mid caps, small caps starting to move. You're seeing the international sector moving. Does that give you more confidence in this move overall with the market?
As I mentioned, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Generally speaking, broadening is a very good sign when you're recovering from a bear market. Let's focus on, for example, the Russell versus the S&P for a second. Now, when Russell is moving up from a depressed area, you saw that back in after the dot-com bust, for example, after the financial crisis. The first phase is for people to buy the well-known names. The early recovery will be the well-known names. People get into names that are comfortable with. And then the real recovery started to come in when the Russell started to outperform the S&P. So you will see some sharp moves of Russell outperforming S&P for a while. And then the improvement will become much more gradual, much more steady. And that's the healthy portion of it. Now, when Russell outperformed S&P dramatically within a bull market, however, these may be signs of trouble. Now, combine that fact with the recent survey of investors' intelligence and so on, market sentiment has gone way too bullish. So people are now very comfortable buying the lesser names, if you will. And I think that actually is a sign of worry. It concerns technicians when sentiment becomes way too bullish. So yes, it's good that there's broadening, but it's a double-edged sword. Again, it wanted to broaden, so the market participation will be wide and most stocks will be benefiting. But when people start to come in with a sort of bottom fishing mentality, and combined with the fact they are pulling out of the high flyers of before and then now are going into a low price stock, that may not be the healthiest sign. So now we have to worry about whether it's just a short-term rotation or it will cause problem later on. Because once the market is fully participated, then you got to ask who's left to buy.
You know, Jonathan, for a longest time, there was a phrase used, TINA, there is no alternative to stocks. I mean, if you take a look at some of the yields, I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen, a 20-year corporate bond is 3%, a 10-year corporate bond is 1.6%. If you're looking at treasuries, even though yields have backed up since this summer, you're still looking at the 10-year under 1%. So as you're looking at interest rates, we've seen a sharp run-up since the lows of August. What's your take on interest rates here?
We believe it's going to stay low for quite some time. You can look at it from several fronts. Politically, yes, I'm no geopolitical expert, but technicians like to follow the Fed, and now Feds around the world. They are basically in no position to raise rates right now. So on the political front, it will be dangerous for them to lift rates too early given the pandemic. And also many parts are experiencing slowdown that's happening faster than they anticipated. And also inflation is relatively tame. Now 10-year yield is low, but when you look at inflation adjusted yield, it's actually negative right now. If you take, for example, the 10-year yield minus the year-over-year CPI, you're looking at roughly minus 0.25%, if not lower. So we don't see policy changes anytime soon. And structurally, yield has been in a negative trend, has been in a downward trend for quite a while. And the shift from falling yield into rising yield usually take years and years, if not decades. And currently we're in a low inflationary environment, so government doesn't feel the pressure to lift rates yet. So we believe rates will stay low and probably range bound for a while, perhaps even test recent low, but it's going to stay low for quite a while.
Now, what about gold? Gold had a nice run-up. It's still up, what, about 20% for the year, so it's not a, you know, it's one of the best performing asset classes. What about gold here, given the fact that, you know, deficits are exploding and there is some talk that one of the big surprises the market's not ready for next year is a rise of inflation?
Negative yield, real yield, is actually very helpful for gold. We saw that back in the roughly around 1973 into 74, and also late 70s, and then a couple of times over the past decade, as right now, negative yield has helped gold. However, real yield has started to back up just a little bit, and I believe that's hurting gold near term. So gold might pull back another 5 or 8%. Now, structurally, however, gold is still in a nice consolidation. Its recent pullback is testing the breakout level. So structurally, we still like gold. Now, that said, the reality is if inflation does creep in and if yield does eventually start to move up, turning the real yield positive, that would hurt gold. Okay, so we got to watch for that. And my mentor, well, Luis and my mentor, Alan Shaw, used to say this concept and this reality. The concept is that gold is in a structural bull market, and that should last for decades. Now, the reality is that there are several wild cards, as you have mentioned, if inflation does creep back. And right now, there are no clear signs of that. But if it does creep back, it could lift the real yield quite a bit, and that will create problems for gold. And as for short term, we see pullback possibly 5 to 8%, but that does not hurt it structurally. So that's the extent of, that's the extent of damage I can see for now. And then it will take a while for us to actually see signs of inflation. Even if there are talks about it, the technical signs are not quite there yet.
So, Jonathan, as you're looking at this market, you mentioned some of the things that concern you is sentiment. We are seeing a rotation. It looks like money's moving into value. As we mentioned, we talked about financials and energy. Given this, is there anything else that would concern you about the market's advance at this point or something that would make you more cautious about putting money to work?
Besides those, they're actually very few signs, immediate signs, that is. Okay. So sentiment obviously is a big concern. And like I mentioned, the broadening of the market actually is not all it seems. We mentioned that there are more stocks lifting with the AD lines and so on. But these are share-based statistics. When you look at the dollar volume, again, that's when you measure the amount of money that are being bought versus the amount of money being on stocks that were declining. So it's advancing dollar volume minus declining dollar volume. The statistic hasn't looked that good for the past month and a half or so. So that is the major concern. And that tells me the broadening market improvement plus a small cap and mid cap outperforming large stocks is a sign of bargain hunting. And they are using the money that are being pulled out of the high flyer, of the previous high flyers. So it's just transfer of money. And during that transfer, some of it is lost because the dollar volume, advancing minus declining dollar volume, is actually falling. So that rotation is losing some money. There's friction in there. So it's not a total energy transfer, if you will. So that is the main concern there. So like I mentioned, broadening is a good sign. But when you have the market broadening with less money coming in, and that is just bargain hunting and not with all their investable money. So that would be my biggest concern.
So, Jonathan, if you had new money to put to work right now, where would you put it to work?
Some of the IT area and consumer discretionary area were doing very well because the large stocks in there, the high flyers were lifting it. But now the monies are actually coming out of those and going into the smaller names. So some of the underperforming stocks within the strong sectors, previously strong sectors, are now lifting. And also they have structural basis and consolidations to support that. So I will go into those stocks that are just lifting out the basis, but in structurally strong sectors.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
I have a website. It's jtl-mt.com. And information about what we do, who we are, will be on it. And the report, if you need additional information for my report, which will come out beginning of next year. It'll be available late this year, but the first issue will be for January 2021. And for additional information, you can just visit jtl-mt.com, and our contact information will be on it.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, stay safe and happy holidays to you, and come back and talk to us again.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Base metals in general have done very well, ironically, which is strange considering copper is often thought of as a very economically sensitive metal. And certainly we've had some economic dislocations this year, but copper is doing very, very well. Copper stocks are doing well. They're leading the base metal charge. And a lot of that has to do with very strong demand coming out of China. And that's something that, frankly, people, I think, in the U.S. aren't really talking about outside of the commodity markets right now. But industrial demand and commodity consumption in China is running at very, very robust rates.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, you can say 2020 is, I guess, the best thing about it. It's just about over. Maybe 2021 will be better. Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program from Weldon Live is Greg Weldon. Greg, there's all kinds of dynamics that are going on in the market now. We may get a stimulus. We're supposed to get vaccines soon. And everybody's anticipating that the economy will pick up and that the market will do well next year. What's your view?
Well, I mean, if you talk about the stock market, I think that, you know, certainly it is long priced in some return to normalcy, although I hesitate to even use the word normal because there's nothing going to be, you know, similar in normalcy to what we're going to have in 2021. It's going to be a new normal. So many things will be different. So many things will be changed, you know, forever. But the stock market, certainly in the U.S. and other places, has to some degree priced this in, particularly if you look at the consumer side. Consumer discretionary has been an upside leader. It's priced in, you know, way more than I think what you're ultimately going to get. I mean, retail sales have been up, but a lot of nuances in the retail sales data that I think kind of overstate the strength of the consumer. And the strength of the consumer going forward is a big question mark. You still have a massive hole blown open in the USS labor market. It's still dry docked. I mean, you can't even put this thing in the water or it will be taking on water, as we're probably going to see next month, because you're probably going to see a decline in non-farm payrolls, I would think, in the next report. So when you play that off against how many people are going to be permanently unemployed right now, the permanent unemployment is what really strikes me the most, because you're up about 3 million and that is permanently unemployed. So it's not like that's going to come back down. You need to find new jobs, not just rehire people. All right. I love this, how the TV plays it up, you know, 4 million jobs created. No, that's just the wrong way to say it. It's not 4 million jobs being created. 4 million jobs have been restarted, reemployed, rehired. All right. There's not a lot of new jobs being created here. In fact, the permanency of jobs lost is a lot greater, I think, than most people realize. It's in the data. It's very straightforward. So when you play that off against what's probably going to be margin compression, you're talking about a lot of places where I hear a lot of questions all of a sudden about increases in the minimum wage now that Biden's going to be president. So you're talking about, you know, margin compression. You have higher costs for, you know, cleansing. And oh, my gosh, I mean, come on. You're talking about businesses that do survive are going to be having to be really honed in, chopped to the bone, no fat, because it's going to be difficult in terms of margins to kind of produce the same disposable income that we're used to in the past. And at the same time, you're inhibiting to some degree the consumer's ability and even willingness to borrow money. The New York Fed does phenomenal surveys. They just completed their quarterly household credit survey. The average expectation for increase in disposable income going forward over the next 6 to 12 months is the lowest it's been in years. It's 1%. All right, that's the average expectation for growth in income. All right. And against that, you can see the expectations for growth in spending falling also. So that it does, and this thing has been really good in terms of kind of presaging what was to come next in terms of the consumer, because the consumer's attitude is what begets their spending or not spending. I think you have a bigger chance for a consumer cocoon in the first quarter, you know, towards the later part of the first quarter, really just after the holidays, and to expect that, you know, the things that have been priced into the stock market, could the market keep going up? It could, for one reason, and I go back to the great Jim Grant, Grant's Interest Rate Observer, who said this, and I quote it all the time and ask this question. The stock market is mistaking liquidity for solvency. And that speaks volumes to where I think you're going to go at some point in the future. So for me, yeah, stocks keep going up. There's a ton of liquidity. There's a lot of cash on the sidelines. People want to plow into stocks. You've seen some liquidation of gold even to go back into stocks, although that was overplayed by the media compared to what's flowed into gold. That's been very small. But I think the real opportunity going forward is in other places. We know that bonds are virtually worthless, at least treasury bonds, because they pay you nothing. They protect the nominal amount of your money, but doesn't protect the purchasing power of your money. That's where gold and Bitcoin have proven that, you know, over a five-year period, you put money into a five-year bond, that money's not going to buy you what it did 5 years ago when you get paid back. And that leaves the commodities markets. So I think that's really our focus right now, is not so much the stocks, but really the under-owned, undervalued, and set to appreciate, I think, rather dramatically, commodity sector.
Speaking of commodities, let's talk about gold versus the cryptocurrencies. Greg, you've got Bitcoin, which has gone from about 4,000 to 19,000. Gold isn't doing as well. Is money coming out of gold going into cryptos?
You know, Jim, I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I would make this analogy, and this is actually just off the top of my head as I heard you posing this question. First thing is cryptocurrency. It's not a currency, okay? And it's almost fraudulent to the degree that the symbol for Bitcoin is a gold coin with a B as a dollar sign. So you're going to say we're not gold and we're not the dollar, but we want to look like that, all right? So that's number one. Number two, there's value in Bitcoin. It's a commodity, plain and simple. It's mined like gold, a lot of differences. The first one is Bitcoin is created by man in the netherworld of cyberspace versus gold, which is produced by the universe at the last seconds of a supernova. They are the rarest elements, not on the planet Earth, but in the universe. Number two, Bitcoin, in the case of a CME, solar, you know, a coronal mass ejection, something like that, where you knock out, or a terrorist attack, where you knock out the power grid on the planet Earth, you're not going to be able to get food or water with Bitcoin. It's going to be worthless. All right. I want to own both, because both offer you some protection for the purchasing power of your money as global central banks continue to devalue money, all right? The other thing I would say in that context of why I own both is, and the crypto people are so against gold, it's like they're using gold now to try and attract people, like gold is this archaic relic that has no value whatsoever. Nothing could be further from the truth, because that's like saying, say you're a doomsday prepper, and you're going to prepare, you know, for whatever event and end to crops and food and supply and all these kinds of things. It's like saying, you know, I'm going to own Bitcoin would be like, and only Bitcoin is like saying, I'm going to have a huge supply of food, but no water. And gold would be the water. So why wouldn't you prepare for food and water and own both? Because ultimately, they are both protectors of the purchasing power of your paper money.
You know, something else, speaking of commodities, Greg, that really strikes me is, you know, they're talking about maybe with the Biden presidency, we're going to go more green. You're going to see more electric cars here in my own state of California. You're not going to be able to buy gas cars after 2035. But all that electrical, all that green stuff runs on copper, runs on nickel. Let's talk about those two base metals right now.
Yeah, we love them both, Jim, and we've actually been long them both for some time. We bought copper, actually, it's funny you're asking me, because I just did a special report on copper. We're publishing as soon as I get off this interview with you, so all your listeners are free to email me, and I'll get you on the list and get a copy of that. The bottom line is, yeah, I mean, you talk about, and man, there's so many tangents on this, okay? One of our best plays this year has been solar. We've been involved in solar from last year, even, so it's been a great play. I think wind is now starting to kick in as another play. But, and the call there was so easy. When you see students at Ivy League universities, you know, commanding the field during halftime of a football game, demanding that the endowment funds liquidate their petroleum holdings, and the endowment funds say, okay, I mean, telegraphing one of the biggest moves in history, you know, fiduciary responsibility goes out the window. That was an easy call. From here, it's a little trickier. And you hit it on the head in terms of nickel, particularly because you want to put all these electronic vehicles, the EVs, on the road by a certain time. 2025 was one of the first hurdles. I think COVID kind of pushed all that back a little bit. But the numbers, to me, when I look at the numbers, it's an immediate gut reaction that these numbers are way too optimistic in terms of the capacity to put these kind of vehicles on the road with batteries that will work. And a lot of that, of course, nickel sulfate, a big component, back to nickel. You're going to be in a deficit in nickel within probably 18 to 24 months. All right. They can't mine the stuff fast enough to meet the demand. So unless you find new technologies around the batteries, which is certainly possible, you're not going to have the, it's not going to be as rapid an ascent, I think, as has been priced into the market. Now, where that creates opportunity is actually gasoline. All right. You have disinvested, every dollar pretty much from these, petroleum companies. All right. They have huge amounts of debt. Many of them are upside down. They're dead. They just don't know it yet. And the problem therein lies that maintaining refineries is an expensive process. We don't build new refineries in the U.S. and haven't for, 30 years? You're going to have issues down the road with gasoline because you won't have enough electronic vehicles on the road to diminish the demand for gasoline to the point where you're not going to be facing potential shortages down the road. And I'm talking longer term, 2 to 3 to 5 years from now. So I think there's opportunities actually in just in owning gasoline outright from this perspective. But the movement is solid. The movement's going to go forward. And I think that what makes it interesting is, I'm for anything that, helps the environment. I'm particularly, in line with the let's remove all the plastics from the ocean. I'm big on that. All right. Because that's something we actually caused that we can fix. To think that human beings are the cause for global warming is really kind of ridiculous to me because it's solar warming, Jim. I mean, the entire solar system has moved into a different place in the universe now. And it is one that is creating this dynamic. Certainly human beings are not responsible for the fact that the ice shelves on Pluto are melting. So there's no cause and effect here. And this is not something that's going to change. And when you go into 2021, you start talking commodities. All the risk factors line up as being potentially bullish for commodities in the sense that kind of the destabilization of this planet scientifically, you're talking millions of years, 25,800 year cycle is the first one. You put that into the cycle around the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And that's a 230 million year orbital cycle. I mean, these are massive changes in a universe that is a very violent place. And to think that, human beings can control this, let alone eliminate it or fix it. And I love how Biden says he's going to, quote unquote, end global warming. There's no such thing as ending global warming. It's hundreds of years of cycles that we're facing now. My point is this. 2021, everyone's saying 2021 is going to be better than 2020. What if it's not? What if there's something different waiting for us in 2021 of a destabilizing nature like COVID has been? And what if that is physical in nature, affects the planet in some way, that puts a lot of these commodities at risk? You could see food prices soaring. I mean, I'm not saying doomsday scenario. I'm saying subtle changes and shifts that have significant impacts. So I think when you look at risk reward, which is the most important math you can do in what we do, the risk reward math is hugely in favor of owning commodities right now, at least to some degree in every single portfolio.
Well, if you just take a look at how difficult it is to not only go out and make a discovery, there hasn't been, I think, maybe one major copper discovery in 2015, that's been it. And even if you make a discovery, Greg, it takes 7 to 10 years to bring a mine on stream. And that goes for oil wells as well when you're talking about, going out and finding a new oil deposit like offshore Africa and then bringing those wells online. So doesn't that tell us that somewhere mid-decade, we're going to be in trouble, whether it's wanting gasoline or having enough copper and nickel to make electric cars?
No doubt. And I mean, you already see that in the number of commodities kind of moving into backwardation. I particularly like the ags. I mean, demand for protein in China. We've talked about this before on the show, Jim. I mean, demand for protein, particularly soybean meal, soybeans in China, people don't realize. I mean, it hits a record every single year. Global demand hits a record every single year. And people talk about, growth, in demand is down. It's growth, okay? So, I mean, phenomenal numbers And that's all well and good up until, you know, right through a couple of years ago, three seasons ago now, where you had bumper crops of this in South America, soybeans, and in the U.S. for soybeans. You had so much corn produced here in the U.S. They were storing it on football fields out in the, you know, the middle of Iowa because they had no place to put it, right? That, over the last three seasons, that scenario, that oversupply, that, you know, bushels of, you know, millions of bushels of crops that we have basically rotting away because we can't use them is gone. Last year in particular brought the dagger into play here in terms of that scenario because you had the flood, you had much reduced crops. This year, one of the things we were saying from the very beginning of the year, we've been bullish on soybeans all year, was that the yields were not going to match what the USDA was projecting. It was way too optimistic. And that's exactly what's happened here too. So you've seen soybeans, cocoa, coffee, sugar, a lot of the food groups. I mean, you know, even to the extent that livestock is well positioned here, the food sector and the DBA is the ETF that plays off the commodity sector, agricultural commodities, is breaking at like a 13-year downtrend because it didn't participate in 2011 like the metals did and the energy did in the commodities rally. So we like that. We like the DBC, which is the commodity ETF for the entire sector. It's a little too energy weighted. I think energy will lag, generally speaking, but we'll also appreciate. Let's not forget, we haven't mentioned probably the most important thing here, which is the dollar, all right? Because it's violated its own multi-year uptrend line. And not only that, whereas in this last kind of weakness in the dollar, the weakness in dollar actually started versus gold back in when, yes, August of 2018. When Chairman Powell first laid out this whole dynamic that was going to become this year's change in monetary policy strategy and goals. And if you remember back in August when they announced this, the FOMC printed, or rather published, over 300 pages in 11 different white papers on exactly what the policy was, how it was going to be implemented, how it would work. And all of this, again, goes back to August of 2018 when Powell started talking about R-star. Okay, R-star being the neutral level of policy rates. And R-star for the globe was then virtually zero, all right? And Powell was very specific to say, this is gonna pose long-term problems for central banks, including the Fed, because with R-star, it's so low, it inhibits our ability to stimulate the economy with monetary policy. And thus, you're looking at a situation, this is him speaking, where recessions will be longer and deeper and recovery to be more shallow and shorter lived. And, it, you know, in an emergency situation, it can be very difficult for central banks. And that's kind of what you're facing right here. Because, you know, the only thing to have left is to print money and tell you that even when that money starts to create inflation, we're not going to raise interest rates. And that's exactly what they've told us. So I think with that in place, as you're, you know, pouring gasoline on the fire that is already kind of the commodities markets and the dollar not only breaking down, but also now where we're seeing every emerging market currency, right down to things like Vietnam, Pakistan, some of the most underplayed, Brazil and Russia, starting to break out. To me, you see the EEM breaking out. The EEM, the Emerging Market Stock Index, MSCI index, is breaking out against the S&P 500. So I think, man, there are so many tells right now that lead us in this direction of overweight in commodities, and I think the dollar has been one that we haven't even spoken about, which is probably the most important. The dollar is beginning a new secular bear market move because it's the relief valve and the only card they have left to play.
Speaking of the dollar and what this also implies with monetary policy being what it is, Greg, in the financial crisis, the Fed jumped in the mortgage market, they jumped in the treasury market. This time, they've jumped in the corporate market. So if you take a look at what your investors are getting in corporate bonds, I was looking at my Bloomberg the other day, and you've got things like a three-year Microsoft bond that pays less than 0.2%. And what I want to talk about is what that implies for portfolio construction, because for decades, it was 60% stocks, 40% bonds. If the market went down, your interest rates fell, your bonds went up, and they offset some of the downturn in stocks. I don't know how much further they can bring interest rates below zero. I just don't think that's going to work in the future.
Well, no, and that's exactly our play here because, and I've actually been doing a lot of public speaking on this, because it is, the bonds are worthless. They're worthless. I mean, they're just worthless pieces of paper at this point in time. And the primary reason is they don't pay you anything, all right? I mean, it's fixed income, right, Jim? Have they changed the language yet? Because they call it fixed income, but there's no income, all right? Let alone the fact that it doesn't protect the value of your money. It merely protects the nominal amount of your money. So again, you buy a five-year treasury bond. You get paid nothing, all right? When you get that money back, that money buys less than it did 5 years ago, all right? Why in the world anyone would want to own a bond right now? Like you say, it's for safety's sake when they can cut interest rates. They can't do that anymore, all right? And here's another point I have to bring up too, because you have a lot of people now calling for the Fed to offer forward guidance on QE, okay? Because the yield curve is steepening. Well, let me tell you, Jim, that's not happening, all right? And here's why. They want the yield curve to steepen. Powell, in addition to R-Star back in August of 2018, the other thing he started talking about, six regional Fed presidents in the next 3 months marched out and said the same exact thing that doesn't happen by accident about making sure that inflation expectations do not become unanchored to the downside. Meaning, if people believe that prices will be lower in the future, they'll not spend and wait for prices to come down, and the debt deflation certainly would be the doomsday scenario for the Federal Reserve. All right, Powell has spoken to this. His very first Jackson Hole speech was specific about this, that we know Volcker taught us how to defeat inflation, right? So let's get inflation, because deflation is the real risk here, because we can defeat inflation. And what they have said now with their 350 plus pages, I read every word of every page, and I'm shocked that more people didn't, because you have guys, and I won't mention names, that are the most respected in our industry on CNBC calling for the Fed to offer forward guidance on QE. They're not gonna. They specifically, we're talking 350 pages of FOMC publications. And one paragraph was given to forward guidance on QE, okay? And they call it FG. They created all this syntax. It took me an hour just to learn the syntax, all right? But FG on QE, forward guidance on QE, basically said it doesn't work. And let alone the fact that part of this whole thing is the Fed wants, before you can create inflation, you have to create inflation expectations. The yield curve does exactly that when it is steepening. So I think to whatever degree the Fed wants the yield curve to steepen, because it anchors inflation expectations to the upside. So again, bonds, why? I just don't get it. And we have done presentations here in Palm Beach where there's a lot of wealth down here. All right. And this is something now, it's picking up steam. I'm going to ask this more and more. It's kind of, the word is spreading. This guy in Palm Beach says bonds are worthless, right? And all these portfolio managers, want to, 60, 40, 65, 35, 70, 30. I mean, I don't know that there's any portfolio I've looked at in Palm Beach that doesn't own a decent percentage of bonds. All right. Bitcoin, gold, commodities. Those are the three you want to replace your bond portfolio with. They will protect the actual purchasing power of your money in a way that bonds can't. Do they give you income? No. Are they volatile? Yes. Could you lose money? You could. But let me tell you, I mean, you could lose money. In my opinion, right now, commodities are a much better mathematical situation, a much better technical situation, a much better fundamental situation than is the stock market in the U.S.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if you put out a lot of stuff on your site, tell our listeners how they can find you and what they're going to find on your website.
Sure, Jim. Thanks. Well, it's weldononline.com, and that's one word, weldononline.com. We offer Weldon Live as our main product. It's a daily kind of institutional type of product, but we have retired individuals in Florida that love it too. So we cover everything, and we have specific recommendations in stocks in terms of the ETFs, country by country, sectors. We do a lot of that work in terms of overweight, underweight in an overall stock portfolio. We're not anti-stock guys by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, actually, one of our biggest positions this year has been long the Taiwanese stock market. So from that perspective, you can come in, sign up for a free trial, and take a look for yourself.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, stay safe and happy holidays.
Well, it's around that time of the year where we bring out our crystal ball to think about what is the future going to look like in front of us, especially as we near 2021 after a very momentous 2020, the beginning of a new decade. Is 2021 going to be any different? What are some of the things that you as investors need to know when we think about the future in front of us? Jim, let's kick things off with today's big picture. And where would you like to take our listeners today?
Well, we're calling this Life After the Pandemic, a look at the future in front of us. And Chris is, you know, I guess the best thing we can say right now is 2020 is just about over. I think this is a year that everybody would like to forget about. So we're now talking about 2021. What does this mean for the economy? What will this mean for you as an investor with the stock market? And just about everybody that you're looking at, and we'll do our annual forecast show at the beginning of the year, but, you know, just reading the materials, everybody's saying that 2021 looks better from an economic point of view and a market point of view than 2020. And the reason is, Chris, everybody is banking on the vaccine. In other words, we're going to get the pandemic under control. You've got Congress talking about anywhere from $1 to $2 trillion of a stimulus bill, looking closer now to about $1 trillion, but I don't think that's going to be the last stimulus bill. You're talking about the Fed still printing about $120 billion a month. So you're talking about almost $2.5 trillion of either fiscal or monetary stimulus hitting this economy. And that's why people are looking that next year, some of the themes going forward are very positive for not only the market, but also for, let's say, the economy. So as we come out of these lockdowns, as companies start going back to work, bringing employees back to work, the economy or economic activity should pick up, and therefore corporate profits, and therefore the stock market.
You know, Jim, one of the things that I've been telling people when it comes to the pandemic, especially as it unfolded here in the U.S., is that Americans just weren't prepared for any type of global pandemic. In most instances, when there's been something like this that's happened, it's typically been isolated to parts of Africa or Asia. But we've never really had to deal with that here. We've never had something of this scale hit our shores, probably for 100 years, if you want to go back to 1918, if that's the best analog. But what were some of the lessons that you would say, you know, investors should keep in mind when we think about how the pandemic affected Americans, consumers, and the economy at large?
You know, Chris, I think one of the things that hits me is technologically advanced as we are as a society. I mean, what do we talk about? We talk about technology. How did we get through the pandemic? Technology. The one thing that strikes me is technologically advanced as we are, we weren't prepared for the pandemic. We are now in the shutdown mode, our third in California. The number of outbreaks of infections are the highest that they've ever been, far surpassing the big spike that we saw in the summer. So if masks and quarantines or lockdowns are supposed to stop the spread of the virus, it sure isn't working because we're on lockdown number three. Number two, the number of cases, as we're talking about, is larger right now than it was, let's say, back in February and March or early this summer. And the problem that we're trying to do is get to this herd immunity, and hopefully the vaccine's going to help that. But Chris, you can't get to herd immunity if you got everybody locked down. If you take a look at, for example, here in California, only about 2 to 3% of coronavirus cases are coming from gyms, restaurants, nail salons. It's mainly coming from work and staying at home. Well, how are you going to get herd immunity if you keep people locked up in their house? In LA, they don't want you going for walks or going for bicycle rides. So the way that this has been handled will probably, you know, historians will look back 20 and 30 years from now and see how we weren't prepared for it and how we mismanaged it. Shutting down your economy is not the way that you cure or get your herd immunity. And, you know, not to mention the irreparable damages it's done to the economy. Depressions are up. Suicides are up. People aren't taking care of regular ailments because they're afraid to go to the hospital because they'll get COVID. So, and a lot of what we've seen our politicians do, it's been more political science. Big case this week, you had that one LA restaurant owner. She spent $80,000 to outfit her restaurant to serve people outdoors. What happens? The mayor comes in, closes her down with the shutdown, And yet right across the street are a bunch of tents for a Hollywood movie studio that's serving its employees luncheons and dinners while they're doing a movie. So a lot of this is more political. And as we've seen all these stories where the politicians aren't following their own advice, whether it's wearing masks or social distancing. So what it proved, Chris, we weren't set to handle this type of a crisis. I mean, as you mentioned, crises were always something that occurred someplace else, in Asia, in Africa. Or, you know, it kind of reminds me, Chris, for those of us that are Californians, anytime we looked at natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, volcanoes, those kind of traumatic tsunamis, these were events that occurred someplace outside of California. We got occasional earthquakes until all of a sudden we start getting fires. And now fires are a major hazard here in California. So, you know, once again, it's disasters were something that happened someplace else because we were too advanced technologically, which showed us that we weren't prepared for it, number one. But getting back to technological advancement, look how fast that we have come up with the vaccine. This is a new first for any country to come up with a vaccine within, what, 8 or 9 months of the outbreak?
Yeah. Oh, right. I mean, it's a major advance that we've seen in biotechnology with the mRNA vaccines. It's going to change how we treat disease going forward. This is crossing a new scientific threshold, technological threshold. So it's pretty fascinating. And there's a lot of different trends that have come up because of this, you know, just in terms of digitization of the economy and other things that we've seen. Two major breakthroughs that we're going to discuss next week on FS Insider with Woody Prusel from 13D Global Strategy and Research are two of the major advances that we've seen in artificial intelligence this year, which has the news around that has been slightly sidelined by COVID data. But we're talking about scientific breakthroughs that were once thought impossible to ever be cracked that just got cracked in recent weeks. So there's a lot of big things taking place under the radar. So what are some of the trends that you're looking at that have been accelerated?
Well, you know, let's talk about what you just mentioned, digitization of the economy. And, you know, you talked about artificial intelligence. We cover the area of health a lot on lifetime income. And there's a new home gym called Tempo Fit that uses artificial intelligence. So as you're going through your weightlifting routines with your instructor, it is also has a camera with AI capabilities that is looking at your form in the way you do your exercise, and with AI, it will correct you. So, you know, we're seeing digitization, AI permeate all forms of technology and all elements of our society. And this is, you know, this is just in healthcare that we're talking about. You take a look at what we're doing now with fitness apps, what we're doing with fitness watches. You know, take a look at the Apple Watch, which not only can give you an EKG, monitor your heart, but now is an oximeter as well, measure your oxygen levels. So we're seeing these advances going on. And the other thing I think you're going to see, Chris, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, is you're going to see online shopping merge with brick and mortar. I hate to tell you, but online shopping is not profitable. Amazon doesn't make its money from selling you something at the retail level. They make their money from selling you cloud services. So you're seeing a lot of the more successful retailers are merging their business with online, whether it means in-store pickups or let's say deliveries to your home, whether it's goods or groceries. And you're going to see that. You're going to see more companies like Target, Costco, Walmart, Nordstrom's, all these big department stores are developing an online presence. And then you're seeing in the stores, they're starting to move shelf space that was for display and selling items for pickup items. So, you know, you order something online rather than wait, you go try it on, you go pick it up at the store. That's going to accelerate. The other thing that you're seeing, and we're seeing this with real estate, is remote work. We're finding, as we are in our own business, I mean, we as an office have been operating remotely since, what, the middle of February. My realtor was telling me about one of the trends we're seeing in San Diego is we're seeing San Francisco and LA people move down to San Diego because they think the cost of living is cheaper, which is funny because it's expensive here. I don't care where you live in California. But one of her clients, it works in the tech business, social media in Silicon Valley, but they're working remotely. So he bought a house here in San Diego and he flies up to San Francisco, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks. So teleworking is going to be a new aspect. Businesses are finding they don't need as much retail or commercial space as they once did. Healthcare trends, telehealth. I mean, I don't know about you, Chris. The last three appointments that I've had, including part of my physical, have been with meeting on a Zoom with your doctor. So that is becoming more prominent. The other thing that we've seen with this, and I think this is something that we're going to deal with mid-decade, and this was a trend that was in place, it doesn't matter which party is in place, and that's the new monetary theory of MMT. So if you take a look at what we've been doing with this pandemic, is the budget deficit this year was $3.1 trillion. It's estimated next year's budget deficit could be $4 trillion. And it's this idea you can spend as much money as you want, finance the debt, and just have the Fed print the money to pay for it. And sooner or later, we're going to run into a financial crisis with government debt somewhere down the road. I mean, you just simply cannot be adding debt, and more debt without eventually running into problems. And it's one of the things that you're seeing as the central banks try to control the level of interest rates. I think it's estimated that the Fed doesn't plan on raising interest rates until the year 2025. So these exploding budget deficits that we're using to spend and give people money to buy goods and services at the same time we're shutting down the economy of goods, producing goods and services, is the result is a massive amount of debt and money printing, which down the road that we know is going to lead to problems.
Earlier, you're talking about some of the trends that have been accelerated because of COVID. And, you know, when you think about the digitization of the economy, I think, you know, many of us understand that there's a power law distribution that takes place within the economic system or the financial system, where big businesses tend to get bigger and they tend to grow exponentially, where the smaller ones die out much quicker. And we've now seen that just on overdrive in light of COVID, where these big tech companies have now grown immensely. And yet now we see smaller companies, particularly small businesses, just get taken out to the woodshed. And so now this has created is something that we've been talking about on our show with another Gilded Age, right?
You know, it's amazing. I was watching two docudramas on Amazon, one which I watched for the second time, but I watched it because of the docudrama that was right next to it on my menu list, and that is The Men Who Created and Built America. So they talked about J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, these titans of industry in the Gilded Age, the amount of money they made, but how they built this country, whether it was from steel, consolidating oil, the automobile manufacturing, putting together companies as J.P. Morgan did. And it reminded me, and then there's another docudrama. It's called The Gilded Age, and you talk about this tremendous wealth. Well, take a look at some of the tremendous wealth that is built by these tech pioneers. I mean, take a look at Jeff Bezos. What's he worth? About $170 billion, and that's after a divorce. You have people like Elon Musk that's worth about $155 billion. Bill Gates worth over $100. So you have this enormous wealth. But you also have these companies that have created these oligopolies and monopolies. For example, if you take a look at the apps that we use on our smartphone, two companies, Apple and Google, control 98% of all applications. If you take a look at the search engine, you know, Google controls over 90% of that. And what these companies have been able to do, these tech behemoths, they've been able to buy anybody that starts a competitive business with them. So they own Instagram. They own all these WhatsApp. They own YouTube. They own all these various venues that we use in social media. And it's not surprising that we're now seeing movement politically, as we did in the Gilded Age. It began with Tarbell going after John Rockefeller and eventually breaking up Standard Oil Trust, and Teddy Roosevelt going after, you know, the big trust busters. So what did we have this week? We had 46 states' attorney generals bring lawsuits against Facebook. We've seen the Justice Department bring a suit against Google. And going with this, as we saw in the Gilded Age with William Jennings Bryan and the movement with labor unions, we're seeing the move of populism and socialism. So think of populism with Trump. Think of socialism with the Democratic Party. Just as we did at the beginning or the end of the Gilded Age, which was brought in with, you know, muckrakers like Tarbell going after Standard Oil and its practices. You had a couple other people in New York City going after some of the political parties in Iowa. So a lot of this is, it's amazing, Chris, we're repeating ourselves 100 years later, but that's one of the things that's coming out of the Gilded Age and today is these technology behemoths that we've seen now in Google, Facebook, in some of these companies, the power that they have in terms of their ability to influence elections, censor what you read or write. And now we're seeing that backlash, much as we did at the turn of the century.
So, Jim, we've talked about a lot of big picture trends so far in today's show. Let's bring this down to some of the investment implications, and especially how we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are approaching the markets and the economy for the long term for our clients.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been a big, strong proponent of dividend stocks. And for the first time in my career, you've got individual stocks paying and offering investors a higher yield than what you can get in bonds. I mean, there's just no value left in bonds. And if you take a look at reading Fed minutes and what the experts believe, they don't believe the Fed's going to be raising interest rates until 2025. So when you take a look at interest rates today, 10-year Treasury yield 0.9, and believe it or not, that's up from 0.5%. You got a 30-year bond at 1.7%. It's not much better on the corporate bond market because you have the Fed intervening in the corporate bond market. So if you look at BBB rated bonds, which is roughly about 50% of all investment grade bonds, the yield on a BBB rated corporate bond is 2%. If you look at junk bonds, the yields is 4.2%. So if you look at the corporate yield curve, it's not much better than what you can get in the Treasury yield curve. So if you look at 10-year corporates, they're 1.67. You're looking at 30-year corporates, 2.63. Compare that to 10-year treasuries at 0.9 or 30-year at 1.7. So if you take a look at that, where are you going to go for income? If you're retired, if you're a pension fund like CalPERS, how are you going to meet your 7.25% or 7.5% mandate to maintain your pension benefits when you have yields at 1% and 2%? You can't. So I still believe in dividend-paying stocks, but I believe, Chris, in this decade, as I wrote in 2003 when I wrote the next big thing this decade is going to be commodities. And we're going to get into green here and the green folly. But copper, lead, zinc, silver, gold, you want to talk about the green economy? You cannot talk about the green economy unless you're willing to talk about lead, zinc, silver, and copper, because that's what the green economy works on. And one of the biggest follies that we're proposing in trying to drive in our economy, and it's not going to work, is this new green economy. Because green only works and can be built and operated and maintained only with fossil fuels. And we're going to get into that. So one of the problems is we want to go to this green economy. We want to have more of our electricity come from windmills, solar, or some kind of renewable type of energy. The problem is, as we move more towards this, let's say, green economy, that means electric vehicles. It means electric trucks. It means electric trains. What does that require? It requires electricity. But more importantly, it requires raw materials. A electric car uses 3 to 4 times the amount of copper in a regular car. So, and when you think about that, we're trying to go green, but what do we need? We need raw materials. You need silver. You need lead. You need zinc. You need copper. Well, guess what? Those minerals have to be mined, which means mining companies have to use heavy earth-moving equipment that runs on diesel fuel. So the idea that we want to shut down our nuclear power plants like California has done, as Germany has done, and these other countries shut down our coal and gas plants, how are we going to power those cars in the future? And the other thing is renewable energy is resource intensive. Wind and solar requires 10 times the quantity of materials compared with using hydrocarbons. And I want to give you just an idea of what I mean by this, Chris, because as I was doing research for this, it's amazing when you look at it. I was reading a report on energy, and this just kind of blew my mind, but it'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. For example, if you take a single electric car battery that weighs 1,000 pounds, it requires extracting and processing some 500,000 pounds of materials. So averaged over a battery life, each mile that you drive an electric car consumes 5 pounds of earth versus a gas combustion engine, which only burns up 0.2 tenths of a percent of liquids per mile. So you're using more raw materials to make clean green energy, and that's the folly. And it's Rystad Energy and the IEA just came out with reports this week that said that because of underinvestment, when the price of oil began to drop beginning in 2014, when the Saudis had an oil war trying to drive U.S. shale producers out of business, large companies have been divesting themselves, not making the needed investments to replace the reserves that they're using up each year in production, because the depletion rate is now running somewhere between 5 and 7%. So according to Rystad Energy, we're going to need to find 300 billion barrels of oil just to meet our energy needs here in the next decade or two. So this idea that we've reached peak demand and that you and I, Chris, are going to be driving electric cars in 10 years is not going to work. And I've maintained here, by mid-decade, we're going to have another energy crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen. It'll make 1974 oil embargo look tame by comparison. And I don't care if you're looking at Rystad Energy, IEA, it's all of this new green economy that we're talking about runs on raw materials and energy. If you have an electric car, you park it in your garage at night, it's on the grid consuming energy to recharge those batteries compared to your gas car. You pull it in the garage, you turn it off, and it's not consuming anything. So, Chris, it's not going to work, and I believe it's leading us to another crisis that we'll see probably mid-decade. So one of the trends that I think, you know, as we sum this up, we were not prepared for a pandemic. It's obvious. And one of the lessons I hope we learn from this is, you know, it's like they always say, generals are always fighting the last war. So given this pandemic, we're probably going to have to change a few things. Having all your drugs made in one country like China probably doesn't make a lot of sense. So you're going to see some changes there. But are we prepared for the next crisis, whatever that is, whether it's a crisis in the government bond markets where bond investors rebel, or it's going to be where we run out of cheap energy, and which means as we try to shut down energy in the U.S. and go towards green energy, we're actually making the Middle East a more powerful player in the energy market, because Middle East energy is now back up to 33% of annual energy needs globally is being produced by the Middle East, which is the lowest cost producer. So I would say for this decade, you know, we're long dividends and we're long commodities.
Well, Jim, it's good to know that we have a team of advisors, strategists, and people that are watching the markets regularly looking at these various trends. We've been discussing about how we've been positioning increasingly towards the commodity sector. As we discussed on FS Insider this week with Adam Rosenzweig, last year in 2019, we reached a 100-year low in commodity prices relative to stock prices. So that was a pretty clear indication that things had gotten stretched one direction or another. And if we look at it, gosh, copper has been doing very well. So I have copper mining companies, a lot of the areas that we have been investing in, as we've been discussing on our show for quite some time. So with that said, how can our listeners get in touch with any of our advisors to know how we can assist them with any of their investment needs?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939, and one of our advisors would be more than glad to sit down with you, help you plan your future, think about investment strategy. There are a number of services we provide, whether it's managing corporate cash if you're a company, 401k plans, personal financial planning. We do a number of those things and be more than glad to talk with you. But in the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.